Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to the latest edition of the El Arpa podcast. This is part one, and joining me is Mary, of course. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
That's good. So basically, we are going to be talking in part one about this and that, a few books that have fallen into our laps, even one in a foreign language. More on that in a second. And in part two, we're going into Mary's area of expertise, objects of lujo, no, luxury objects in the ancient world. We both went to that exhibition, and we gave our thoughts on that in part two, and in part three, of course, rounding up and all that crack. So, yeah, you've seen the books. Every time you're here in the office, you see what new books have been added to the collection. And one is by Michael Palin, about a ship. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And you are a little bit dubious about that, I think, because you think ship stories are boring.
Yeah, because they usually have a lot of detail about parts of the ship and things like that that I don't know about, and also about storms, and it's just a lot of, I don't know, it's very descriptive, and normally I get a bit lost.
That is true, actually, because I remember buying Master and Commander after seeing the movie Master and Commander, and it was nothing but very tedious descriptions of every part of the ship. But I had to flick through this book, and I have to tell you that Erebus by Michael Palin, the Times in the front cover calls him a natural storyteller. And it's true. It's a story about a ship that was around during Queen Victoria's era. And basically, it ventured south for the furthest distance known to man at that time. Then it went on a second voyage and basically disappeared in 2014 when she was discovered again. And this is essentially the story of the novel. So it's really, of the ship, I should say. And this is really more of a, just a really, I don't know, rip-roaring adventure from what I can see. I really want to dig into it more. It is a story of a ship, but also the people on that ship, Queen Victoria's era as well. But also the whole spirit of adventure and kind of venturing off into the unknown, which for us is space now. But not everybody can be an astronaut. But back then, probably, it was more accessible to go to the ends of the earth. I think you just had to be poor and willing to sign up to a ship, I think. So I think this is going to be a really interesting story. I mean, you are obviously familiar with Michael Palin from Monty Python, whose anniversary it is this year as well.
Yes, from the Train Programs.
From the Train Programs. Yeah, he made one Train Program like back in the 90s, but he's made a new one as well, has he?
I don't know, I mean, to see the European Railway ones in the Travel Channel.
Ah, okay. Well, I'm a big fan of Michael Palin, you know. So.
No, the documentaries are really good because he goes all over the place by train, and sometimes he goes reading like old travel books and things like that, and then it's quite good. He's quite interesting.
You know, I think he is, because I think a lot of travel shows fall into the pit of being overly dramatized. Like, especially the ones he would go on. Because there's a couple on Discovery that would be cartoonish in a way, you know. There's one guy who tracks big fish in different parts of the world. And it's always a bit like white man descends onto the natives and tracks these prehistoric animals. But Michael Palin, and then on the other side of the scale, you have like very frothy, like, I mean, in Ireland, the only travel program we have is hosted by Tommy Bowe, a former rugby player, which is fair enough, but just for holiday goers and nothing really in depth. The closest we came to it was Hector O'Hagan, who did travels around for TG Cahir, which was the Irish channel, which still is the Irish channel. And they were really great because they had no budget, but just this huge spirit of adventure, and just took the Irish language and the people watching it just all over the world. I think Michael Palin does a great job of just, yeah, as you said, using these resources, connecting to the stories of different adventures. He's a very educated man. and kind of bringing his own inimitable absurd comedy style to the presenting as well. It's always a bit off kilter as well. No, it's always a bit kind of like barmy, but in a very positive sense.
I think he's quite natural talking to people, which is nice. It's good to avoid this thing that you were saying of the noble savage.
Which we cover in our book as well, in a couple of chapters. And the other book is A Thousand Splendid Suns, which is written by the same author of The Kite Runner. Mm-hmm. And you're very excited about this. You haven't read the second book by this author, but you really loved...
What second book?
Well, this is the second book written. I'm not saying it's a sequel to the first story, but it's...
Yeah, but I've read them both.
Oh, you have? Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, I told you I read them both, but I prefer this one.
You prefer A Thousand Splendid Suns?
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me why.
No, well, the historical background is very interesting, all about Afghanistan in the 70s, and just basically, I don't know, how the country went from like one foreign country spoiling it to another, basically.
Well, yeah, that is interesting, because I sent you the trailer, or an interview on News, no, not Newsnight, that's BBC, it was on Channel 4 with Jon Snow, with Chris Morris, who's of Brass Eye. And he's famous for making Four Lines as well, this kind of black comedy about this Muslim terrorist cell in England. And his new movie's similar enough, but he said like his next project potentially could be about the Iran coup of the 1950s, which also is another story of how the British tried to maintain their dominance over very cheap oil supplies, were plotting against the leadership were thrown out, and then they got the Americans to do it. So yeah, these kind of stories seem to be kind of coming more to the surface, but it is obviously instrumental or fundamental for us to know this aspect of it, to understand you know, the Middle East, because I think it's very easy for people who don't know this colonial side of it to just assume that there's something funny over there, and you know, there's just a predisposition to the chaos, when it's not really the case. It's just, as you mentioned, successive foreign powers have been meddling in the affairs there as well for different generations, no?
Yeah, and I think a lot of people just don't grasp, I don't know, geopolitics, because, for example, the strange thing with Afghanistan is that all the period where it's under Russian influence is something that, I don't know, people don't, or many people don't immediately associate Afghanistan with Russia, for example. And that's, I think, a big part of the book is based on that period. And I think that's very interesting, because obviously it's from the point of view of the population. So it's just useful to know, even if it's through fiction, but to know like how the different powers or the different like occupation forces influence people's lives.
Yeah, okay.
Mm. But I don't want to say any more, because you haven't read it.
I haven't read it.
But it is pretty tragic, I have to say.
I can imagine.
So don't be down before you read it.
I won't be in a bajon.
Or you'll be suicidal.
And also as well, just before we finish this part, what's the maddest thing you've heard this week?
The maddest thing I've heard?
Yeah.
I don't know, probably something by Trump in... China,
well,
for example.
I've subscribed to DAZN, DAZN, the Spanish provider and Spanish commentators when they talk about Ireland. And imagine most other countries that are outside of Spain are talking through their You said literally, because like Brendan Rodgers, as I said to you, his parents, he's from Northern Ireland, his parents are Catholic and Protestant, and he just, for some reason, could not wrap his head around the commentator. And he was like, did you know? It's like the Hutus and the Tutsis. It's just like, Mom, my boyfriend's Protestant. And he just like kept going on and on about it. It's just like, well, first of all, I don't know why you're conflating these two complex but very different stories in the middle of a match. And also just like not dropping it. Okay, you introduced it. It was stupid. But you persist with it. It's
what
insane.
Is such a boring match?
No, it was great.
You also know.
And City lost as well, so Liverpool have secured their lead at the top. Who's your favourite Liverpool player?
Well, now Sadio, no?
Sadio. Because he's outscoring Mo Salah.
Well, because I just like learned of his existence just now, so.
Well, he shouted at Mo Salah 2 weeks ago.
Did he?
For being selfish.
Well, okay, that serves him right.
No, Salah actually isn't selfish because he has a lot of assists. Well, he had last season anyway. Anyway, it's enough football talk. This is not a football podcast.
Not a football, hashtag not a football podcast.
So what we'll do is we'll move to part two and we'll talk about luxurious items of the ancient world. The wine at the wedding you were at recently was subpar. Subpar.
I thought you were being French because there's a lot of French people at the wedding.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was good.
The wine?
The wedding.
Oh, yeah.
Next question.
That's good. And no runaway brides? Anything like that?
Brides. When there was only one bride to start with, thank God for that.
Okay, otherwise there'd be just too much action going on. But at weddings, you have luxurious items. Alright? Segway clacks on.
Segway, yeah.
And we went to the Kaiser Forum to see luxurious objects exhibition. And I think we had an idea of how we would feel when we went there. And it was kind of more or less borne out by our experience. But since I am a modern historian, and I don't even have a PhD, just have an MPhil, perhaps Dr. Correas, the archaeologist in chief, can you tell us, like, can you break us into this? Bring us into it. You're speaking from a position of authority and experience here.
Okay, well, I'll try my best. It was an exhibition about luxury items in the ancient world. So we basically went because we were pretty sure that the narrative was going to be about, you know, elites and how the elites conveyed their principles through luxury objects. And, mm-hmm. Well, I suppose because we're so interested in social history and not so much in, like, the usual narrative, which revolves around the elites.
Yeah.
Because we are lefties. No.
Well, that's true. We are true. We don't. Yeah. And you were a girl. You didn't even like the shiny, pretty things.
Yeah, exactly. That's like, okay. Whatever.
Yeah, it was a joke.
No, there were some cute things. Well, there were. No, but...
Hey, we're in a museum, not Tiffany's now, so let's focus.
In reality, yeah, but this is the point. This is exactly my point. You go to a museum to learn things about the ancient world, and okay, it's good to know that there is trade and, you know, raw materials and all these things, but that was the, I would say, smallest part of the exhibition, but most of it was pretty objects, and the narrative was pretty much about how, you know, the elites used those objects to exert authority over the population, which is true, but then I was just wishing that it would have been a different narrative, kind of like focusing maybe on how different cultures influenced each other, more of that aspect, for example, which is quite important, and also through raw materials and what materials are used in different regions. It's possible to trace trade and, for example, focus more not just on what you were talking before about, like, the people that went to the other side of the world because they were, like, poor. So, for example, like, soldiers or people that went into expeditions to get raw materials, to get, like, precious stones, things like that, luxury articles too, or the places like that's also a way of knowing who has traveled where. And the aspect of the craftsmen and basically like people that knew how to work those materials, and even if they were anonymous, because obviously in the ancient world like authorship wasn't a thing, but still it's possible to know what people and knew how to work the materials. And I don't know, there are like so many more aspects related to society that you can even get, even through luxury objects or like the absence of, you can work all those things out. That is not just the narrative of like, wow, this is beautiful and look at how skillful they were. And
yeah, because like the panels in the wall just repeated that kind of in each section. They made pretty things. And you're right, there are things you can extrapolate from that. There's three things that kind of jump out at me now as we're talking about it. It didn't occur to me when we were there. So, I mean, I could have wowed you with that back then. first of all, like, well, I did mention this to you, that like, it is interesting that, you know, because we did a lesson once before about how when humankind in the Stone Age period took care of fire and shelter, they invented music and things like that. But they also, like, from very early on, even from our prehistory, the use of gold and jewelry to denote status and superiority was very much at play. So I thought it was maybe surprising that that wasn't there, because I think if you frame it around that, it makes it a lot more interesting that this is something that's like intrinsic almost to human societies. Secondly as well, they mentioned the Persians and how the Persians were quite adaptable. They didn't really care where things came from, that they just took, you know, styles and fashion and materials and just like to incorporate it into these new things. And that's interesting, but also what was missed there is like the Persians were seen as effeminate, and like how trade could also be transferred into kind of like national stereotyping and what effect that would have maybe militaristically and also politically. But also I remember as well, during the summer I went to St. John's Castle in Limerick, and they spoke about how the castle was built, and that like they said you know, some of the stonemasons came from France and other parts of the world. And you met them, you know, there's a character playing them on a video screen and talking about it. Now, okay, the facilities in Lacaitia Forum don't allow for that, but I think you could kind of say, well, most of the artisans were this or more, you know, they came from here and this is the type of profile, you know, that they had. And it kind of like makes you realize, okay, who, like the builders or the creators of this stuff were people in a kind of fuller sense rather than just like they made pretty things, you know. And actually, speaking of the artisans, you said you also commented on, because they did a reproduction of a glass bowl. It wasn't an original. Most pieces in the exhibition are original, but this wasn't. And the artisans were also fundamental and crucial to the spread of culture and the spread of beautiful things, and how they made glasswork and made these intricate designs on the glasswork, you know, with very rudimentary techniques. So again, you can even impose like this, I mean, working class hero narrative, you know, is it like the artisans were the people who, you know, ultimately it was the kings who adopted it and displayed their wealth, but without these artisans making these things, there would be no, there wouldn't be any luxurious items, and they didn't really feature very prominently in the exhibition either, you know, so.
No, they didn't. I think, well, obviously, like, artisans are not kind of like the lowest of the classes, so that more of like a specialized class,
which, yeah, they're not kings though, are they?
No, but you know, so like, okay, let's say it's a certain type of like middle class. But even so, I mean, you can already work out two different social groups. Like, we're talking about the kind of soldiers maybe, or people that took part in the expeditions that could have traveled to these places to get the raw materials, for example. And also you can talk about the artisans. So that's already, you know, a big segment of the population that is not necessarily the elite.
Yeah.
I think what you said about the stereotypes is very important. So it's kind of like, I mean, it's obvious that only like rich people can afford certain types of material, or something that is like very, you know, the harder it is to do, the harder it is to have it, or to make it, the harder it is to have it. But I don't know, it's just like a very simple approach and kind of like almost like antiquarian type of approach to objects. And that's what like frustrates me, because at the end of the day, the objects are just a way of like knowing more about people. So the object by itself to me says nothing. Yeah, it's very pretty, but that's not the point of it.
Yeah, well,
in terms of archaeology.
But I think, like, as we mentioned there, if you see a beautiful thing that a rich person could own today, it might be nice looking, it might, but ultimately boring, I guess, you know? Because you walk past rich shops that have, like, gold cigarette or cigar holders that are worth 600 euro or something like that. And yeah, like, I mean,
some people like that.
Yeah, that's why it's fine. But like,
it's not archaeology.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, but like, I think, you know, you look at pretty objects from the past, and it's like, okay, yes, this material came from far away, and that is impressive, and that's what gives it kind of its value more than it being a pretty object, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, you mentioned the soldiers. There are things from soldiers that are represented there, and probably some of the strongest elements in the exhibition as well. And again, you can take it away with this if you want. It's like stuff on the for the horses, the stirrups, and also things on the armor. You know, and also I think on the reins of the horse, they might put some things there as well.
Yes.
So maybe you would like to explain more.
Yes, I think you're talking about some of the decoration for the harnesses for horses, and it's very elaborate. And then, well, normally there's always the idea that they wouldn't have been used, either ceremonial or not, obviously for not going into battle, but for a special occasion or something like that. I think, see, for example, that just in that glass cabinet that had the harness decorations, there was already so much of like symbolism of what those things that were portrayed actually represented for that culture. And, you know, it goes together. Like, it's pointless just thinking that those things are just lavishly decorating just because it's a nice occasion. No, like, all those things, like, there's a reason for them to be there. And they evoke things that people can identify and you know, myths, stories, former rulers that people can identify that person that is carrying it with, and even like enemies and, you know, previous battles. So, yeah, they're pretty, but that's the least important of its characteristics, even back in ancient times.
Yeah.
So it just seems like a pity to just leave it as in, wow, this is like very pretty, and they used it to impress.
Yeah, well, maybe I can ask you a question as well, is because like in Latin America or Hispano America, I'm confused about which term I have to use. You know, in the Aztec and Mayan cultures, gold was not used as a currency. Cocoa beans were, and so gold like had.
What's he using now?
I am quoting myself. Yeah. If I don't reference myself in the book, I'll sue myself as well. But anyway, so the gold, like, obviously there still had a great ceremonial value, like it does, or like we've seen in this exhibition as well. Maybe you can fill in the blanks for me as well. I mean, was the gold used as a currency back in the ancient world as well? I know that's a huge swathe of territory and empires as well. So it's, you know.
So for Egypt, for example, no, I can tell you about Egypt mainly because it's an interesting case because there is no currency, there's no coins, basically.
Yeah.
So, well, it's just exchanging goods.
Like grain.
For example. No, not like grain. That was the second point. How do you know that?
Yeah.
I was like, what is the word that I'm looking for that is not bargain? Is
barter. Yeah.
That's it, barter. And yeah, so for example, in that case, and also like grain is more for like paying people. So like the same as we have the word salary from like salt that the Romans used to pay, for example, the soldiers. So instead of salt, they used grain.
Okay. So they had a granary every month.
Granary, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, what's also interesting is like, I know your background in archaeology is very mud brick house centered, and also with an interest in toilets.
Yeah, in my previous life.
But I've never like, I mean, you've been to these houses, you photographed them, and you've had this lived experience with them as well. Since we're talking about objects, and we've never spoken about this. What was inside the house?
That's a very interesting question, because inside most of these houses there was nothing at all. First of all, like, people that live in mud-brick houses in Egypt are very poor, so they virtually have nothing.
So these are the poorest of the poor.
Pretty much, yeah. Then some houses, yeah, that's something striking because they're just completely empty. There's just nothing there. But then other things are mostly related to agricultural life. So the ovens are usually inbuilt. But then in terms of objects, you have, for example, cages, like bird cages that are made with reeds.
Yeah, okay.
And also they collect a lot of, that's quite funny, because they collect a lot of egg, you know, this like carton thing for the eggs.
Egg carton.
Yeah, so they just like use it to like pile it on top of each other, and that sort of acts as if it was like corrugated sheeting for like the roofs, for example, and as insulation.
Wow.
They make use of everything they have around, and yeah, it's mostly those sort of things. They're mostly practical things, and then, for example, maybe oil lamps, because obviously those houses don't have electricity.
Yeah.
That sort of thing, and then agricultural tools like implements, things like that. Not much more, to be honest.
Okay. Yeah.
Not luxury objects, but for them, well, it's just what they need. And
yeah, and speaking of Egypt, in the exhibition they had a few things from that era, like perfume bottles and things like that, which I thought was kind of more interesting, at least just for me subjectively, because it's just more everyday stuff, you know, it's kind of more functional and things like that. But again, you are the expert, so I mean, if you had to curate, you know, objects from ancient Egypt, what, I guess it's how you frame it more than what's there, as we've been discussing, like by framing it, contextualizing it, that really makes it more impactful or not. But still, if you had to choose pieces for this, what would you choose?
For the luxury objects one.
No, could be anything.
For fantastic objects of ancient Egypt.
No, literally could be anything. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think the things for me personally, obviously, because I'm interested in life, social history, the most important things are the ones that tell you how the house was used and how people lived there. So aspects of everyday life, Egypt, ancient Egypt, has so many objects for everyday life. You'll be in shock if I show you some of them. Not just to do with like how people like lived practical things, but also, for example, games, toys, that there are so many examples of. And it just gives you a really good idea of, I don't know, like how people pass the time, and even entertainment, they're like really insightful objects. I remember like a story I always tell when I'm in the museum of like an administrative building that had on the floor, basically it looked like people had been waiting to do some paperwork, and then they sort of like scratched the lines to do like three in a row or some kind of game like that. They just scratched like a board game on the ground.
Vandals.
No, but like it was quite interesting, because imagine, like, it's so fascinating to think that people, imagine like here you're in like social security or the Hacienda or something like that, in tax office, and you're just waiting and you're so bored that you start scratching that and you start playing like, you know,
table football,
something like that, and then that you have that like 3,000 years later, I think that's like quite fascinating.
No, it's definitely
insight into like people's lives.
Yeah, well, when I went to Berlin and went to the East German, the DDR museum, basically we saw like a lot of representations and of things people used and what their daily life is like, and it is very impactful because you do build up a better picture of who people were, and that is infinitely more rewarding as a museum goer. And you mentioned games. I think the best room in the museum for us was the kids' room. Because
it always is.
Because they have things like you can play with. And last time we went to the musical objects of the ancient worlds, yeah, and you could make music. And then yes, the second thing was, well, now for this luxurious objects thing, they had like a wall with like different shapes of pots and things like that. You could take two sheets of paper, mix them together, and create your artistic design for this luxurious object. And it was good. Yeah, I liked it.
I think it's really cool. It's because they had the sheets with the material and then the designs.
Yeah.
So it was creative, but I think it was quite educational because, like, you could do probably not, you might not get it right that that shape came in that material with that design, but it just gives you like an insight into what different materials they could use and what would be harder to shape into a certain type of vessel, like what would be like more malleable, for example. And also like the designs, the things that you could do. You did a really pretty one that was actually quite historically accurate as well.
Obviously.
Well, you're a modern historian, so.
But I dabble. I dabble.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, let's go into the luxurious objects of part three. You can find our blog, irishsliceofmadrid.com. Well, the blog is
on that address.
That address. What's it called? Irish Slice of Madrid. irishsliceofmadrid.com. You can find us on Patreon and Twitter, Instagram. Even though we haven't been Instagram for a long time, so let's get back on top of that. And where else can you find us? Well,
Facebook.
Facebook as well.
And the podcast.
The podcast.
On the podcast platforms.
There's been a Bollywood baby, I've heard.
Yes, Leo.
Is he expected to follow the family tradition?
Of course. Yeah. From the mother's side.
Of course.
From the father's side, he'd be a security guard, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, that'd be a great romance novel. The security guard and the Bollywood dancer. Was he security guard at one of her events?
No, no.
It wasn't some kind of like bodyguard with Kevin Costner.
I don't think so.
Has he or has he not lifted her in his arms to escape from a crowded
presumably before she was pregnant?
Probably. Well, congratulations to the little Bollywood baby. And
for being born.
For being born. And so hopefully the baby, when he grows up, can appreciate luxurious goods of the ancient world also. Which would be proof that we still have a civilization after the twin threats of Brexit and Trump. Anyway, so you can join us next week for the latest edition of the Elaborate Podcast. This is me saying good luck.
Bye.
The Elaborate Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.